Do I need to push this over? Okay, while we're getting set up here, let me go ahead and introduce who I am. I'm not the Dr. J, the 76 basketball player. I would love to be able to fly like he does, and I would love to be able to play with a ball like he does, but I'm the other Dr. J, Dr. J. Smith. And I have been working in the Muslim world for 45 years, so I'm probably the oldest one around here who's been working in Islam. They call me the oat, the oldest of all time. And because of that, my work has been mainly with Asian Muslims, not with Arabs, because that's where I grew up. I grew up in India. My parents were missionaries in India. My grandparents were missionaries in India. Their graves are there. My parents' graves are there. I do not plan to die in India. But that's where I was born and grew up. So I grew up with Muslims all around me. We have 220 million Muslims in India, the second largest Muslim country on earth. Now, you don't think of that India as being Muslim. You think of it as being Hindu. 800 million Hindus, that's why they dominate. But we have now surpassed Pakistan as the second number two in the world. Bangladesh is number three in the world. And if you just take those three countries, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, you have 600 million Muslims, which is twice as many as the entire Arab-speaking world. Do you see the problem? Most of our missiology has only been geared toward the Arab-speaking world here in America, which makes sense because there's a lot of Arabs here. But when you leave America and you go over to Asia, or even if you go to where I spent 25 years in Britain, 70% of all the Muslims are from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, where I grew up. And they are the ones that are attacking us, more so than any other. Arabs really aren't attacking us because we don't really appear on their radar. The Christian church, that is, or Christians. So I have been working in this Asian part much more so, well, for 45 years, obviously. Now, tonight I'm not going to talk about that. Tonight, George has asked me to talk about this subject, the Iran conflict. How many people have heard anybody unpack the Iran conflict before? Raise your hands. Okay, two or three. This is one thing no one wants to talk about in the churches, and we need to start talking about it. What in the world is happening right now? Our country is at war, and we're not even talking about why it's at war. There is a history going on there that no one's really bothered to consider, because no one wants to see why is it and who is it or what is it that's happening that's causing us to go to war, and not just us, but Israel to go to war. So what I want to do, and this is the first time I've ever really used this. In fact, I just put this PowerPoint together this afternoon because I felt it was better if I sit there and actually go through the points by sequence rather than just do off to my head. So this is, bear with me, this is the first time I've actually really taught this. But to introduce this subject, there are some areas we need to note to begin with. Let's do some background history. To understand what is happening now, we need to look at some history as to where it's come to and why we are at where we're at. And to do that, we need to look at the Middle East in the 21st century, in our century, in what's happening immediately. And we need to look at two areas. We need to look at the Sunni versus the Shiite categories. Because there's an enormous amount of confusion in America and all over the world, but mainly in America, as to who is it we're confronting. Are we confronting the Sunnis or are we confronting the Shias, the Shiites? So when you look at the Middle East in the 21st century, in this century that we live, look at the historical events. These historical events that are happening, we're not paying attention to. Who has been creating most of the violence in the Middle East in the 21st century, in this century? Hold on, be careful. Not Shiites. Al-Qaeda is not Shiite. ISIS is not Shiite. No, there's Boko Haram or Al-Shabaab or Lashkar al-Taiba or Tabakli Jamaat. These are the guys I have to work with. These are the guys I know personally. For 25 years, I have been face-to-face with many of those who joined ISIS. And I had to confront them weekly at Speaker's Corner in London. Al-Qaeda is a little different because they then moved out of, they are Arab, but they moved over to Afghanistan. Boko Haram is in Nigeria. I go to Nigeria every year. Every October, I'm in Nigeria, and I have to take on the Boko Haram. I also go to Kenya. I was just in Kenya last October, and all the large buildings, the tall buildings that are shooting up, those are all being created. They're all being bought using Minneapolis dollars by Al-Shabaab, by the Somalis. Yes, that's right. The Somalis are taking over Nairobi. And most of us are not paying attention to that. The Lashkar-e-Taiba coming out of Pakistan, they are the ones that attacked India, but you didn't hear about it in the news today. Or the Tablighi Jamaat. This is the one that I've had to deal with. The Tablighi Jamaat have been around since 1926. How many even know what the Tablighi Jamaat? Raise your hand. Who knows what this group is? You know what it is? You know where they come from? Nope, not Pakistan. They come from Delhi, where my parents were ministering. 1926. And they have been around Kandlawi, who is the leader and the one who created the Tablighi Jamaat, to reform Islam from within and take it back to its roots. They've been around for over 100 years. 100 years exactly now. They now are in 200 countries, and they have a membership of 80 million. 80 million. Most of the people that were bombing us there in Britain, the 2005 bombers, those four young men who blew up 52 people there in London, they are part of the Tablighi Jamaat. Many of the guys that I have to debate there at Speaker's Corner for 25 years, they are members of the Tablighi Jamaat. We call them TJs for short. But how many of you have even heard of this group? The largest radical group in the world, and no one here in America knows about them, because you're spending all your time only looking at the Arab world. Without looking and asking, there's a much bigger problem happening in the Asian world. The numbers are humongous. That's the world I have to come from. That's the Sunni world. These are all Sunnis. All these groups are Sunni, not one of them Shiite. Have you noticed that? So far, not one of them is Shiite. Note that, I just said that, didn't I? Most believed in using violence to eradicate non-Muslims and their beliefs, which would bring about peace by replacing those beliefs with a very orthodox, radical form of Islam instead. And when you talk to these guys and these gals, which I've had to do so for 25 years, that's exactly what they're saying. And every time they say that, they support it in Scripture. That's why we have confronted the Quran, and that's why we've been exposing these verses. And that's why we go to the Quran, and that's why I spent my last 20 years shutting down the Quran, trying to break it down, trying to make it irrelevant. And that's why so many of us who are in the whole polemics field are confronting that book. These groups, they all want the demise specifically of Israel, though they could not point to any scripture for that support, which is rather ironic because take a look where these groups are headquartered. They're not even anywhere near Israel. Al-Qaeda was near Israel, but it's now over in Afghanistan. ISIS, it was in Iraq, but again, that's the closest. Boko Haram, Nigeria. Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Lashkar-e-Taiba, Pakistan. Tablighi Jamaat, India. What do they have to do with Israel? So why this visceral hatred of Israel in all the literature? You need to ask them that. You need to go back and find out what they're talking about. All of them have either been confronted militarily or they have been imprisoned and have all either been displaced like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Al-Qaeda now has moved basically to Afghanistan. ISIS is now in Africa. When I'm in Africa, I'm confronting ISIS. When I'm in northern Nigeria, that is ISIS. They've taken over Boko Haram and they're now controlling it. They have now taken over the country of Niger. They're also over in where I spent 5 years, just east of Senegal. And they're now moving into the whole Sahel area. Or they've gone underground, like Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, Lashkar-e-Taiba, and the Tablighi Jamaat. They're not really a problem for the Middle East anymore. You don't see these groups in the Middle East anymore. Most of them have gone underground or they've gone to Africa. Going to Africa or to Afghanistan, where the government, the Taliban, now welcome them, or where the governments in Africa are just too weak to stand up against them. And we're seeing that in Nigeria. They're the ones that we have to confront. I don't know if you know this, but 83% of all people, Christians killed worldwide, around the world, are killed in one country, Nigeria. That's why I have to be in Nigeria, with 107 million Muslims, the fifth largest Muslim country on earth, after Indonesia, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Then comes Nigeria, number five. But people are not paying attention to Nigeria. We have to. I have to. I've got to go there to help them out because no one else will go there. And when I go to Nigeria, I have to have armed guards everywhere I go because I'm so high profile. They know who I am. None of them control or are supported by any Middle Eastern governments today who all support Israel. Isn't that interesting? in just this century, almost all of these Middle Eastern countries that started back in the last century when Israel got its independence in 1948 were all against Israel. Have you noticed that they've all now flipped? And so here's the question I'm going to ask you. All these demonstrations against Gaza and Hamas and Palestine, where are you finding these demonstrations happening? Tell me, where you find them happening? Okay, so that's America, right? And in Europe. Have any of you seen any demonstrations against Israel and for the Palestinians in Amman, in Riyadh, in Jeddah, in Cairo, in Damascus? Isn't that curious? Why haven't you Americans picked up on this? I say this to the Europeans. I just got back from Germany, spending 3 weeks going to all over Germany, and no one had picked up on this. I said, there's a curiosity if the countries that are right next to Israel are not confronting Israel, and yet everybody that's confronting Israel are in Europe and the United States. Am I the first to ask this question? I'm kind of looking at a lot of blank faces. You must have heard this before. You must have thought this through. Please do, because we've got to see what's happening, what's going on here. Let's continue on. Privately, you will see that every one of the Middle Eastern countries now support Israel. Publicly on the ground, you will see some people who are on the internet that are confronting Israel, but they don't do it publicly, because in order to do it publicly, they will get arrested. Why in the world would they get arrested for confronting Israel? Now let's go to Shia. So that's the Sunni problem. The Sunni problem, I don't know of any really Sunni country that is attacking Israel today yet. Oh, they will say publicly, and they'll make that, but that's not what they're saying privately, and that's not what they're saying to our government. But when you get to Shia Islam, now we're change our focus. Let's now turn our attention to Shiites, and notice which are the groups that are attacking Israel. There are three groups that are attacking Israel in this century. Hezbollah, since 1982, Hamas, since 1989, and the Houthis in Yemen since 2023. They all start with H. That's how you can remember them all. HHH. Now, two of them make sense because two of them are very close to Israel. They're on either side of Israel. And they all want the demise of Israel. And they want to use it. When you hear this slogan, from the river to the sea, let Palestine will be free, that's calling for genocide, folks. The only way you can eradicate, to bring from the river to the sea, that means from the Jordan River, all the way over to the sea, to the Mediterranean Sea, let Palestine be free. They are calling for genocide. And yet that was started by Hamas. They were the ones that created that slogan. And yet you see it all over the United States. You see it all over Europe. That is calling for complete eradication of the Jews. While Hamas and Hezbollah have geographical reasons for doing that, the Houthis have no reason whatsoever. They're nowhere near to Israel. So why are they attacking Israel along with the Hamas? And here's the other thing. Why is Hamas attacking Israel since Hamas is Sunni? Have any of you thought that through? Think that through. Hamas should be the last country that's attacking Israel because all of its other brethren, Sunni brethren, are not attacking Israel anymore. Only Israel has responded to these three. Thus, none of them have been displaced or gone underground. That's why they are by far the most difficult, violent. These are the most violent problems that are happening in the last 10 to 20 years. None of them are supported by any Middle Eastern government. Note, there have been no public, I've just mentioned this, there have been no public demonstrations against Israel or in support of these three in Damascus or Riyadh or Jeddah or Amman or Cairo. Why not? What's going on here? What's happening? All three are supported and given funds and weapons by one country, Iran. That's what's going on. Now you might say, well, what is Hamas doing getting its weapons from Iran? Why is it getting all its funds? Because all the Sunni countries have stopped giving it because they realize that the Palestinian issue has been a thorn in their side. We're going to get to that as to what I'm talking about. And that's why they stopped giving funds to Hamas, and that's why Hamas had to turn towards Iran. And once they turned towards Iran, they betrayed the whole Sunni ideal. That's why they're hated by the Sunnis. Have you not heard this before? Is this new for all of you? For the first time in almost a century, one Muslim country is attacking another Muslim country. What am I talking about? We have never seen any Muslim country attack another Muslim country in the Middle East until the last month. The last month changed everything. And Iran has been sending missile after missile to Abu Dhabi and to Bahrain and to Qatar and to Saudi Arabia and to Kuwait. And here in America, we're not paying attention to that. But the Sunnis are. The Sunnis know why they're being attacked. Because they do not want what Iran wants. They do not want to see Israel destroyed. You'll see why they don't want to see Israel destroyed. All three Shiite terrorist groups are controlled by Iran, which has now become a threat to the entire Middle East, with only Israel and the USA confronting them or it militarily. But why? To do that, we need to look at Shia Islam and find out what they're... You need to go back and let's do some theology as to see why they are so different than the Sunnis. The major branch of Islam is known as the Twelver Islam. And the Twelver Islam start instead from the category that theologically speaking or politically speaking, they are the rightful heirs of the Prophet's mantle. So the entire difference between Sunnism and Shiite is who is the rightful heir to the prophetic line. The Sunnis believe that it could be someone from the ulema. You have the caliph at the top, then you have the ulema, then you have the ummah, then you have the al-kitab, and then you have the kafirs at the bottom. It's a very hierarchical state. And so the Sunnis believe that anybody that's in the ulema, these scholars, can be chosen to be the caliph. The Shiites say, no, you cannot have someone who is in the ulema and must be in the line of the Prophet himself. So they start with Ali ibn Ali Talib, who is the cousin and the son-in-law of Muhammad himself. And they go through his line, and that's why he was the fourth caliph, or rather, some say the fifth caliph, because he was the fourth of the rightly guided caliphs, who controlled and lived from 656 to 661 when he was killed at the Battle of Siffin there by Muawiyah, who then introduced then the Umayyad caliphate in 651. So this is Abi Talib. And then Hassan is his son. His son is Hussein. And what these are the caliphs. These are the, not the caliphs. These are the imams, but there's more than that. And we're going to get into that. So hold on to that word, but we're going to get and show you what we're talking about. Each one of these, there's 11 of them until we get down to Hassan al-Askari. And every imam takes over the mantle of his predecessor once that predecessor dies. They all died normally, some died in war, but they all died in their lifetime until you get to the 11th Imam, Hassan al-Askari. He had a son who was born in 870, some say 869, but 870, let's put it there. So when he died in 874, he then took the mantle. He was now then the next progenitor. He was the 12th Imam. And he was then put into occultation. Occultation means he just went underground and he went to sleep. Or he could be alive. We don't know. What the Shiites tell us is that he's still alive today, 1,100 years later. So he's been in occultation for 1,100 years. And that he will return in our lifetime. And that's why the Shiites believe that they're going to bring his return back, to bring about justice and peace. He will be known, he is already known as the Mahdi. When the Mahdi returns, then there will be justice. And then there will be peace. How will there be peace? You need to look at their constitution. You need to look at what these divine imams, what their roles are. Every one of these 12 are known as divinely appointed, known as Nas, as successors to the Prophet in religious authority and guidance. So they have a step above anybody else. They possess a isma, a protection from sin and error. Therefore, they are pure. They are without sin, conveying and explaining divine guidance. They are authoritative interpreters of both the Quran and the Sunnah, the example of the Prophet, what he said and did, and the source of Shia law and theology. And therefore, the 12th Imam, known as the Al-Mahdi, who entered occultation in 874 and will return at the end of time, possibly this year, that's what they're waiting for. These figures are central to Twelver identity, to their devotional life, and to their jurisprudence. And much of Shia hadith and fiqh are transmitted through the fifth and the sixth imams, in particular al-Baqir and also al-Sadiq. So let's look then at what Iran is today. If this is their theology, if this is their belief, then they're all waiting for the Mahdi to come back and eradicate that which is standing in the way. And who's standing in the way? Who are the power brokers of the community today? When you look at Iran today, When the Ayatollah took over in 1979, he introduced the Islamic Republican Guard Corps the same year. And this Guard Corps are those who are then to retain that ideal of the revolution in 1979, to protect that Islamic theology and that ideology based on the Imamites, the 12 Imams. Now, there is another army in Iran known as the Artesh. They do not have this right. The IRGC are the ones who are above the Artesh, and they are the ones who answer only to the Ayatollah. The IRGC, we'll just call them IRGC for short, they number between 150,000 and 190,000 members. Created in 1979 to protect the Islamic Revolution, and they have become the most powerful institution in Iran today. Their principal duty is to protect Shia Islamic ideology. Notice, this ideology is not the same as Sunni ideology. Are you seeing the difference? Sunni ideology does not have an apocalyptic future. They don't have this apocalyptic ideal that the Mahdi will come out and destroy all those who are against Islam. They don't have this ideal. This is unique to Shiism. So therefore, the IRGC are to be used for internal security. Thus, they are only answerable to the Ayatollah, whoever the Ayatollah is right now. Now it's Muqtada. So they are not under control of the government itself. They have their own weapons, they have their own control, and they are the ones who control the ballistic missiles and the drones. They control the Quds Force, that's the external proxy group, and I'll go into them, and they also control the Basij volunteers, that's the internal threat. They control major sectors of the Iranian economy, so that 33% of everything that Iran produces goes to the IRGC. 33%. That includes construction, energy, shipping, banking, and most of imports. And that's why many of the commanders in the IRGC are known as billionaire generals. They are absolutely wealthy because of all the money that they are incurring from all these imports and exports. Let's go to the Quds. The Quds Corps are the core similar to what we would call our CIA. They are the ones who are responsible for all the external and international control. So they are the ones, they number between 15,000 members. They are known as the Quds. Quds means Jerusalem. So they are the Jerusalem force from the Al-Quds. They are the IRGC's elite external operators. They are responsible for Iran's foreign military and intelligence operations, for their organizing and training and supporting allied militias. So they are the ones that get them food, and I'm sorry, they get them weapons and get all the arms to the Hezbollah, to the Hamas, and also to the Houthis. Everything that those three organizations are dependent on comes from Quds. They emerge as a distinct branch of the IRGC after the Iran-Iraq War, and they function somewhat like a mix of a special forces command and an external intelligence service. Their activities have included supporting groups such as the Lebanese Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis, and help organize ground forces against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So that's the Quds force. That's kind of like the international force. They're the ones that go outside, like our CIA goes outside. But they're based on religious edict. They're based on an ideology that is based on apocalyptic vision for the future, unlike our CIA, which is not based on anything other than security. Then you have the Basij. The Basij are by far the more dangerous. The Basij, short for Organization for the Mobilization of the Oppressed, do just the opposite. They do the oppression. They're a mass volunteer paramilitary militia used by the IRGC for internal security, much like our FBI. But whereas our FBI does not oppress, the Basij, that's all they do is oppress. Today, they are numbered between hundreds of thousands and as many as 25 million. Depends on which source you're going to. Specialists today say they are at least a million strong. Now remember, Iran is 90 million population. So they are involved in internal surveillance and enforcing the internal security or law enforcement, and in making sure that there is the morality and the social control of the population itself. That's why they police dress codes, they monitor protests, and they guard regime events. And that's why they have been suppressing the protests that have been happening most recently. In the mid-2020s, they suppressed large-scale protests. But what they did just a few months ago in January of this year, where in two nights they went to 400 towns, and they actually killed 40,000 protesters. The latest reports are 40,000 protesters. You've all heard this. This is nothing new to you, what I'm saying now. That is the Basij. And what they can do is they can bring up to 25 million volunteers to help them out. And that's why you saw the videos of all these men on scooters and motorcycles with their AK-47s just mowing down protesters in the middle of the night there in January. So the roots of the present conflict. Number three, why in the world, therefore, are we there as Americans? To do that, we need to go back to the Ayatollah's beliefs concerning Israel. We need to go back to Israel. The Ayatollah Khomeini, when he came to power in 1979, and also the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was just killed about a little more of a month ago, now his son, Muqtada, is now taking over, but looks like he's in the hospital. They have repeatedly denied Israel's legitimacy, describing it as a cancerous tumor, a fabricated or fake regime, and something that must be removed and eradicated. Khomeini has explicitly said that Iran supports any party fighting Israel, and that comprehensive struggles, political, military, and cultural, must be carried out against this Zionist regime, and this must continue until they have been eradicated. In multiple speeches and posts, he has spoken of eliminating the Zionist regime, wiping out Israel, or ensuring that nothing will be left of Israel. While insisting, this refers to ending the state, not killing all Jews. He has to put that as a caveat. More explicitly, military terms, Khomeini has warned that if Israel attacks, Iran will destroy Tel Aviv and Haifa. And Iranian commanders close to him boast that Iran has encircled Israel from all four sides and that nothing will be left of Israel. Now, how can you destroy Israel so completely? What's going on here? To answer that, you need to go to the nuclear arsenal. The only way you can destroy Tel Aviv and Haifa is to use nuclear weapons. That's the only way you can do it. Now if you understand why they have been irretractable on shutting down their nuclear program. Iranian officials consistently say that the program is for civilian energy only, medical isotopes, and scientific progress. And they cite a supposed fatwa against nuclear weapons. The problem is, if that were so, if they were using for civilian use, you don't have to go to 20%. You don't have to go to 20% of weapons grade. Iran has repeatedly enriched uranium and stockpiled it well beyond the civilian needs. They run secret facilities and in the past operated a covert weapons project known as the Ahmad Plan, leading most independent analysts to conclude that Tehran wants at least the capability to build bombs quickly. Analysts argue that nuclear capability would enhance Iran's status as a leading power in the Gulf and wider region, especially after Iraq's weakening and amid rivalry with Saudi Arabia and other Arab states. Some experts fear it would embolden Tehran to expand support for its proxies, Hamas, Houthis, and the Hezbollah, and their terrorism and coercive diplomacy, calculating that nuclear backing would deter harsh retaliation. Now, we know that about Iran's move from 20% toward weapons-grade level of 90%, because the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, directly measures enrichment in Iranian facilities and reports the results, and because Iran's own officials have publicly acknowledged the technical ability and intent to enrich up to 90%. Once you get to 90%, folks, then you can produce bombs. Enrichment level is not inferred indirectly. IAEA inspectors take samples and use on-site monitoring at facilities like Natanz and Fordow to see exactly what percentage of uranium-235 Iran has producing. For example, in January 2021, the IAEA confirmed in a formal report that Iran had begun feeding uranium into cascades at Fordow to enrich it up to 20%. Similar confidential and public reports since then have documented stocks enriching to 60%, in other words, near weapons grade. These IAEA reports give specific kilograms of material as given enrichment levels, so therefore an X kilogram at 20%, a Y kilogram at 60%, showing that Iran is stepping beyond low enriched uranium and into high enriched territory that is only a short technical step to go to 90%. Once you get to 60%, which is where they are right now, that's 99% of what you need for weapons grade. In order to get to 90%, for that stock has effectively been done. Technically, only a small additional enrichment step is required, using the same or similar centrifuge cascades. Now can you see why this is becoming so important in the last few weeks? Now, the strikes came after the June 2025 12-day war, last June, when both Israel and Iran and the Hezbollah, which had already seen major Iranian missile salvos and Israel attacks on the Iranian infrastructure, and we sent those bunker bombs to try to destroy those 3,000 centrifuges down, deep down, 1 mile underground. We did not destroy them. All we did was cover them up. That's why they've got to go back now to get down there and to get through those centrifuges. In the months leading up to February 2026, intelligence suggests that Iran had further accelerated enrichment, expanded missile deployments, and continued aiming its proxies despite arming its proxies, that's Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis, despite negotiations with the U.S. over its nuclear program. U.S. and Israeli officials later said some targets, especially the Supreme Leader's Ali Khamenei himself and key command sites, were briefly vulnerable and might have gone into deeper hiding if not struck at the moment, shaping the timing of the operation. That's why they had to go on February 28th, because that was the first time that all of the head structures of the IRGC were in one room. And Israel sent in its missiles, and they destroyed all 34 within 2 seconds. But that was the only time they could do that. So there were four major reasons for attacking on February 28th. To prevent Iran from ever obtaining a nuclear weapon, number one. To destroy or severely degrade Iran's ballistic missile forces and their air fence, number two. To annihilate much of Iran's naval capacity and capability to secure the Straits of Hormuz, that's number three. Now, we thought we had done that by sending 159 ships to their graves. But we haven't. And that's been the miscalculation that has come so far. And then number four, to weaken or topple the Islamic Republic by decapitating its leadership and encouraging internal revolt. That has not happened either. So what about the rest of the Middle East? While this is all happening, what's going on in the rest of the Middle East? Why are they not protesting this war? Curious, isn't it? To understand what the Sunni countries are doing, you need to stop and ask, where does their future lie? Okay, here we go. The primary commodity, and in some cases their only commodity, which all of the Middle Eastern Sunni countries have, is oil. They only have one commodity. Outside of Dubai, which doesn't have the oil, therefore that's why they've created Dubai, like a Las Vegas for the whole world. They are the only ones who can do that, but all the monies that are coming for Dubai come from the United Arab Emirates, where the oil is. So they're totally dependent on the oil. Yet most of the world is moving away from oil to other forms of energy. That's the future of energy for us all. So what do you do if that which you have, the only thing you have, is no longer going to be in use in the future and is going to become obsolete? Where do you go? You diversify away from oil. So how do you diversify? Let's take Saudi Arabia, the largest oil producer. What are they doing? Let's use them as an example. Notice what Saudi Arabia has been doing since, about 20 years now, but specifically after 2015, for the last 11 years. Saudi Arabia is diversifying into three primary areas, into entertainment, into education, and into research. Have you all been following this? Listen to see what MBS is doing, Mohammed bin Salman, and you'll see what's going on. In entertainment, they are taking over the sports industry. That's why LIV Golf, which really is the Roman numeral for 54, the number of holes on their golf courses, that's where LIV comes from. This is a Saudi-funded professional men's golf tour that stages events around the world, including tournaments in Saudi Arabia, such as the LIV Golf Riyadh, and rivals the PGA, and the DP World Tours, by awarding larger purses and guaranteeing contracts to its big-name players. And that's why they have been decimating the PGA numbers. They've also tried now taking over professional boxing by awarding huge prize money. Saudi Arabia has made itself the central venue and major league organizer for professional boxing. Now they're moving into Formula One. Saudi Arabia has become the sport's most powerful financial and political player by using state money to buy races, sponsorships, and big teams. And now, fourthly, they're going into world football. One of the most powerful actors in world football today by using state money is Saudi Arabia, using their public investment fund, known as PIF, to buy clubs, host major tournaments, and dramatically inflate players' wages in the Saudi Pro League, all tied to its vision for the 2030 project. How many of you know about the 2030 project? Wait, share your hands. Three people, four people. Folks, you've got to pay attention to what's happening. The 2030 project is the future of the Middle East. And they have to continue it. Education. In education, Saudi Arabia is trying to turn education into a strategic asset on par with the West by overhauling its schooling system and university system under Vision 2030, pouring money into STEM and AI, and inviting top foreign universities to set up inside the kingdom. Higher education is in recast as the engine of knowledge economy, and universities are tasked with driving research, innovation, industry partnerships, not just rewarding degrees. The Saudi Data and AI Authority, SDAIA, has set explicit AI targets. And what they're doing is they're setting up four major universities, two in Riyadh, one in Jeddah, and the other in Aqaba. Those are going to rival Harvard and Yale, Cambridge and Oxford. They have to do so because for the future, they want to make sure education comes to them. And then the third area is the NEOM project. How many of you know about the NEOM project? Well, you know everything. Well done, lady. I don't know how you know all this, but we should use you up here and let you do this. The NEOM project has been around since 2015, though it was really came onto a form in about 2017. And what they're doing is they're building, you're saying 3 minutes? 4 minutes. I'll get it done in 4 minutes. So they're building this line. Can you see the line that's there up on that map? That's going to go from Aqaba all the way to Tabuk, 100 miles long. And it's going to have pods, research pods, all the way through it. And this is going to be the largest building structure in the world, in the history of mankind. You will be able to see it from space. It was launched in 2015, though it was formally launched in 2017 by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. We'll call him MBS for short. Marketed as the futuristic 100% renewable energy development that will house cities, resorts, ports, and industrial zones. Now here's the problem. Here's the difficulty. Something's happening. The problem is this. At the moment, Saudi Arabia has enormous cash from its oil wealth. But this will begin to diminish as many countries move away from oil. Have you seen what's happened in just the last week with the LIV? They are now pulling back from funding it. That just happened a week ago. Mainly because of the war that's going on right now. Also, as we are seeing with the current crisis, much of that oil can be cut off at any time. Look what happened right now with the Straits of Hormuz, cutting off all that oil, 20% of the oil that is used worldwide. This is causing many countries to look elsewhere for oil. And where do you think all the big ships are coming to right now? To the west coast of the United States. We are sending more oil than we've ever done in the history of the United States right now. Mainly because of Venezuela. We're selling their oil. What's more, their refineries and their storage facilities can be attacked and destroyed quite easily. Look how easy it was for Iran to destroy, 2,000 missiles to Abu Dhabi alone. 13 of our soldiers were killed there. Saudi Arabia had one of the biggest oil refineries was destroyed. That's how easy it is because they're so close. So where will Saudi Arabia and the other Middle Eastern countries need to look to in order to support their future plans for diversification, in order for their own future? This is really the future of the Middle East. If there's no oil, where are you going to go? Where, or rather, who do they need the most? No. Who do you use and who has the deepest pockets? You've got to go to who has the deepest pockets. Who have the deepest pockets in the world today? Come on, give me the name. Okay, I'm getting every name but the Jews. Why didn't anybody say the Jews? They are the ones that control the banking, they control the education, they control our film industry, they control the whole Jew. Everywhere you look, the Jews are ahead of everybody. They've always had the deepest pockets. Now, where do the largest Jewish communities live? We have 7 to 8 million living in America alone. That's true. It is in America where the Jews are at the largest. There's 1.4 million in Europe, and Israel has another 7 million. So we have more Jews here than there are in Israel. So in order to get to those Jews in the USA and Europe, the Sunnis are going to have to go through Israel. In order to get to the Jews, you've got to go through Israel. Are you following this? Can you now understand why the Abrahamic Accords were a genius? There was a genius created by Kushner and Trump, because Kushner is a Jew. Trump is a businessman. He knows the future is in business. He knows in order to survive in the future, you have to use business. You have to go where the money goes. And he knows the best thing to do is to get all of these countries to join Israel, so that they will have a conduit, not just to the Jews, but to all of Europe and all of America. Because the one thing we do not want is to invest in a place that has violence. Nobody wants to invest where there's violence. Started in 2020 to normalize diplomatic relations between Israel and the Sunni countries, they already signed up four countries: United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan. They were about ready to sign up Saudi Arabia when October 7th happened. October 7th derailed everything. That's why the Palestinians had to have October 7th. Because no one was talking about the Palestinian issue anymore. For 47 years, the Palestinian issue has been front and foremost for all Muslims until October 7th, until the Abrahamic Accords were signed in 2020. Now can you understand why they had to have October 7th and why they had to film everything that they did so that the Israelis would see it and they would attack them? Are you following me on this? Now, I see that my time is up. I just want to end with that. I'm going to leave you hanging on this. This might help us understand. The Abrahamic Accords were not just going to be for financial gain. They were also going to have trade, technology, tourism, security, and cultural exchange between Israel and all the other Sunni countries. This might help us understand why Israel and the United States were forced to finally attack Iran in February 28, 2026, because the whole future of the Middle East is wrapped up in normalizing relationships between Israel and the Sunni countries. No wonder Iran is a pariah in its own neighborhood. Okay, over to you.